This is Kelly Henderson, and you're listening to the Velvet's Edge podcast. My guest this week is Miles Adcox, who is the CEO of OnSite, a mental health wellness center. Miles has been featured in everything from O Magazine to Good Morning America, and as a huge fan of therapy and interemotional and mental health work, I have been dying for the chance to talk to someone who speaks the language. What's so interesting about Miles is not only his success and all of the countless numbers of people OnSite has helped, but also his continuing growth and honesty in his own journey of mental and emotional health. We each talked about our own experiences with experiential and intensive therapy, why it works, and the language and vulnerability that we hope is becoming more common in our society. Here's our conversation. Okay, so when I researched you a lot, and I was listening to a couple podcasts that you spoke on, and every single person says, "What is OnSite?" And you're like, "Oh, I don't have a full answer, but I'm going to ask you, what is OnSite?"
I know I've got to get better at this. I'm the worst, whatever you call the elevator pitch. I'm the worst at that. But I would say it's an emotional wellness retreat space, and we offer primarily. We're just west of Nashville. We're on a beautiful 250-acre campus out in Dixon County. And we offer short-term therapeutic workshops and intensives. That's kind of what most people know us for. And then we also have on campus, it's a separate location, but on campus we do a kind of a boutique residential program for mental health, specializing in trauma, depression, anxiety. But the workshops we do are kind of for anybody and everybody.
Right.
From living-centered program to we have a trauma specialty and just all kinds of fun stuff.
So when you say intensive, can you describe kind of what that means?
Sure. We were some of the first that in the emotional health, mental health space to start recognizing that the traditional model of counseling and therapy, meaning like a 50-minute session,
right,
has value and has limitation. And so with more runway, you can do so much more. And it can kind of feel, and I do my own personal work outside with a therapist, and for the most part, if I'm doing maintenance work, it's great. But if I've got anything significantly adverse going on in my life, to come out of life into this little curated bubble for an hour and then be bounced back into life can be really challenging. And so this is just a way for you to do a significant amount of those hours in one chunk of time. So take like 4 days, and you can do like, if you played it out, probably 6 to 8 months of therapy in a 4-day window.
I was just about to say that I've done an intensive before. It wasn't at OnSite. It was before I found out about OnSite. But my therapist said, you know, I had been doing therapy for about a year and a half. And she said, "I think you're ready for an intensive." And I was like, "Well, what is this stuff we've been doing called, you know?" And she said, "No, this is literally like going to 6 months of therapy in one weekend." Mm. And it was. But why is that? Like you said, you run into blocks when you do the 50-minute session. What, like, can you explain that more? What kind of blocks?
It's primarily it's when you are opening up on deeper parts of yourself and trying to figure out what you want to reconcile or take a look at it. If you have more time, you can actually move into it at a little better pace. Vulnerability is a big ask. It's getting better because people are now starting to see it as more of a strength. It's trending culturally. But to ease somebody into that, there is a method to that, that done well, you can unlock the answers that I believe everybody has within them. So a lot of people think you go to counseling, coaching, therapy for a solution or an answer. And right. Ultimately you go to discover that you have the solution and answer you're looking for. And if you have time to do that, then there's an art to curating psychological safety and building trust and letting people kind of evolve into their story. And there's an art to using a trained modality that the therapist might be trained in to figure out how to get people to go deeper, unpack certain elements that might be stuck. And then there's an integration piece. So imagine trying to do all three of those elements in a short window.
In 50 minutes.
And you can. There's some brilliant private practitioners that do it. And so I'm not picking on that model. I just like it coupled with, like your therapist recommended, an intensive model where you can really get a jump start.
Yeah, I love that you said the 50-minute sessions are great for maintenance, because I think everyone should be in therapy. I mean, it's the most beneficial thing that I do personally, and it's not because anything terrible is going on in my life. Like, I think that's a huge misconception, but it definitely jumpstarts it to do something intense like that. So can you talk through some of the different activities that you might do it on site?
Sure. We are an integrative therapeutic modality, meaning we take a variety of different modalities, and our therapists, we look for specific talent, clinical talent. We like our therapists to be artists, and so we typically come from an experiential lens, mm-hmm. meaning there's a lot that falls under an experiential umbrella, but it's I guess the easiest way to say it is most counseling is kind of talk yes. oriented or cognitive behavioral, and it's valuable too, but we like to turn the talk into more action and mobilize it, because I think it taps into different parts of our brain, particularly our limbic, where we hold a lot of pain, and it kind of bypasses our prefrontal cortex, which is our rational and reasoning part of our brain, which can sometimes get in the way of healing and finding what we need to move forward.
What do you mean?
Well, I feel I've had to work to get in touch with my emotions, because I didn't really get an early imprint growing up in the South, kind of a man's man that mm-hmm. you didn't feel. And I was somewhat emotionally illiterate. And so put me in counseling when life starts to not work so well, and ultimately you don't really heal what you don't feel. And I had a hard time feeling, but give me a problem to solve and I'll love to think about it and mm-hmm. process it and talk it out. But I walked away not feeling any better or with any change. So I love to intellectualize something. That's a skill that I enjoy too, but it's the skill that most often gets in the way of me being able to access emotion. So sometimes we find, and we get the opportunity to work with a lot of smart intellects and creative people. And sometimes the more we know, so in other words, a lot of the people in the helping profession, psychologists, therapists, they trust our resource too and come to do their work there, primarily because they can take their therapeutic hat off and be a human for a week. Because it's something we ask everybody right. that comes to our campus, is not to reveal your profession. But when they're there, that often is the hardest clientele to work with, because they know a lot. And ultimately, it's an unknowing process. It's unpacking what we think we know so that something can evolve into clarity.
Anytime I've done work like you're talking about, I go in and I'm like, okay, I'm going to work on this part of, you know, like this is my problem right now and I'm going to go address this. And then you go in and you do the work, and especially the experiential type therapy, and it's like, what? This thing comes up that you had no idea you were even holding on to, and it's the thing that you needed to work through the most. Okay, so let's talk about experiential therapy, because I think that it's super helpful, and my experience is I've needed the talk and the experiential.
Yeah.
But it sounds weird, right? Like I was trying to describe to someone what I did at this intensive, and I had a lot of anger from a past relationship, and I had to push my therapist, made me first of all beat a block with like a Nerf bat and then push the block out of the room. It was this huge, like, I don't even know how you describe those. But when I tell people about that after, they're like, why did that help you? So why does that help? Is it just getting it out of your body?
And did it?
Yeah. Oh God. Yeah. I mean, I was so angry, so angry, so angry. And then I pushed the block out and just started sobbing.
Sure.
And then after, there was the biggest release I had felt in years, probably.
Yeah. Well, I think, to sum up experiential, to the ability that the brain can see itself, I feel like it can heal itself. But most therapeutic modalities don't necessarily give the brain the ability to see itself in real time. And so what you experienced, anger gets a bad rap as an emotion. And it's an essential emotion, just like the rest of them. And I don't think anger is the problem for most of us. It's our relationship with anger, because we're told we're not supposed to feel it. Or if we do feel it, something's wrong.
Okay.
And so therefore, we don't allow ourselves to process, talk about, feel anger. And when we don't talk about it, it compounds, turns into kind of this internal rage, and it can create a little havoc. Which is why tools like what you experienced can be really valuable. And they do sound wild and crazy. That's one of the reasons when I'm out talking about what we do at OnSite, I don't really get into the specifics of here's exactly what happens in a group room, because it's out of context.
And also it's different every time, right?
Different every time. We don't do that every time. But that practice actually came from martial artists.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's really, and basically the whole point of it is not slamming a bat to do rage work. It's releasing energy. Mm-hmm. And because toxic energy can end up creating compound stress, and when we release it, it actually lowers our ambient stress level and we feel better, just like you described. But they were the first that came up with that blocker that often you'll find with martial artists that they use to move energy. And it's actually a pretty controlled method. It's not like an out of control. There are people that facilitate it differently, but you're talking about rage or anger release work.
Yeah.
And when you say it that way, it sounds much different than...
Oh, it sounds so beautiful.
Yeah. I'm going to beat a block.
Right.
But ultimately, that's what you kind of do.
Totally.
But it's very facilitated. It's a very controlled environment from the facilitator, but it's also highly effective and not near as scary. But if you were to hear about it on the street, like, this is what you're going to do, I wouldn't sign up for that.
No, all of my friends that I told were like, oh my God, she's really like falling off the deep end because this is what she's doing with her weekends. Yeah. You know? But it worked, man. And I still, to this day, because in that I learned anger is not a primary emotion, right? Isn't it usually covering something else? I mean, this is getting into like therapy stuff, but I can identify now, or it taught me to recognize when I'm feeling that kind of rage or anger to go, okay, what is like really going on? You know, because there was always something underlying for me, but I couldn't tap into the feelings like you're saying.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's the longest journey we take. I say this all the time out at our offering is that 18 inches from our head to our heart. And what I mean by that ultimately is there is a core emotion that typically has a lot of emotions or feelings that we think about that emotion before we ever really understand what it is. And sadness is often at the core of anger. Yeah. I'm sure you saw, which that is atypical when someone's doing anger work. And there's a lot of ways to do that. It's not always with the block and the bat. There's other ways to do anger work, but usually after that release, there you find tears that have been just there and blocked for a long time. And so it's really powerful, but it's one element. It's one tool. In experiential, there's role play, there's drama, there's... I could go on and on and on. We integrate music, art. It's just, it's pretty beautiful, but it's... If you were to walk into an intensive or an environment and we tell you the middle of the book without reading the first chapter, then you would think it was a little crazy.
Right.
And so it's almost like you need a runway and a warm up. And what we've figured out with experiential is it's not new. It's been around for a while, but it kind of lost some of its, how would I say that? It started getting a bad rap because in the 70s and 80s, they figured out how powerful it was as a therapeutic tool. And it was almost like instead of a scalpel to try to do emotional surgery, you could use a machete.
Yeah.
And because it opens people up faster.
It does.
But opening people up to a cathartic experience doesn't always signify healing. And so you don't go after a cathartic experience just to do it. And that's what people started realizing. If we don't get people deep and emotional, then we're not healing. Not necessarily the case as we followed the research over the years. So now we make it an invitational opportunity. We never push or pull people where we think they need to go. And so that's one thing that's a relief when people come to onset. They think that stuff seems weird. Well, great. You don't have to do it. You can still come and participate and benefit without... You can opt in or opt out. And ultimately, we find when people get to make their own decision at what level they're willing to lean in, they're twice as likely to create sustainable change.
That's so interesting, too, because another thing that happened for me is when I showed up, I didn't want to do anything. And I usually will like be open and participate, but it's a vulnerable experience. So I don't know if that's what I was feeling, but I said that and I was able, my therapist heard that and was like, okay, well, what do you like? Let's look at that. And then we were able to see what I was really guarding. And it's just interesting to learn about yourself that way. How did you get into this though? That's what I'm curious about.
It was through the lens of my own experience. If you would have told me 20 years ago, I was going to be in the helping profession or the change business, I would have laughed. I didn't know anything about it, nor did I know I wanted to be in it or it would be a calling. When I trace back into my childhood, I've always had an interest, an empathetic disposition towards underdogs, towards And so I think one way or another, I was always divinely appointed to be a part of this. It just took a journey to get there. So I've always had an ear for people who were going through difficulty or struggle, even as a kid, whether it was people or pets or dogs or whatever. I always had a pack of strays. And then I had my own life experience in my early 20s where I experienced depression significantly and started to medicate and numb that out in a lot of creative ways, and didn't know I was doing it at the time. I've got all the language to back it up now, but at the time I didn't know what was going on. It was very disoriented and confusing. And so I did what we do. At that time, I had a smile on my face and was muscling through and was working hard to achieve so that I could be affirmed by external places. And so you didn't know. And yet on the inside, something completely different was going on. So I was very much unintegrated, if, you know, I guess if you will. So it was through the lens of me going through a adverse time, finding the right resources and the right people to come around me at that time. And when I found it, I mean, I fought it initially and had some resistance, which I think is totally normal. But once I got a taste of it, I had this initial freedom experience. It's hard to describe. It was like, as I described, a lights coming on moment, but it was like I learned a new language. And I was so drawn to it that I knew I had to be a part of it. I didn't know initially that I would do it professionally, but I knew this will be a significant part of my life because it's the way I want to live. I want to be present. I want to be open. I want to be vulnerable. I want to express my emotions. I want to be able to cry. All the things I thought I could never do. It was like somebody just said, oh yeah, this is normal and actually healthy.
Right.
I was like, really?
What? Yeah.
Yeah. And so I was an early adopter. I bought in right on the back end of my own transformation. I bought in and I was like, this stuff could change the world and I want to be a part of it.
So did you have a crash that made you launch into this?
Yeah. I mean, it was, thankfully my bottom didn't get too deep, before people around me helped speak into me and somewhat intervene. Cause the people that, people noticed, particularly people close. I started dropping weight, and my mom was a big advocate for me at that time. And I think she was just out of her own fear. She knows me about as good as anybody. And so she probably leaned in and said, I see something is going on and we got to do something about it. So my crash was no sleep, exhausted, losing weight, unhealthy, running through relationships, just miserable. But I think I was close. I think my bottom could have gotten very dangerous had I not gotten support at the time that I got it. And now that's one of my missions in life is that people don't even have to get where I got. If you have, and it's not necessarily prevention, it's just information. If you had this information sooner, then you can embrace a different way of looking at life and have a different outcome without having to experience some of that adversity. I wouldn't change the adversity because it was all informative. But some of it, you know, was pretty, you know, pretty painful, pretty dark. And I don't think you have to experience that to have a transformation.
I love the part that you said you learned a new language and that was so peaceful. For me, I had a bottom, I guess you would say, too. And as painful as it was to hear someone put a word to it or to tell me, well, obviously this is what happened to you because of X, Y, and Z in your past. You know, those kind of things to be validated in that you're not crazy and there is a whole nother thing out there, but I just didn't know. And you can't do anything unless you know, right?
Yeah, knowing in that environment, and that's what I feel like we're missing in today's culture. And that's one of the reasons why I feel like if we can mobilize this information without the pathology so that it's just for the people who've gone through difficulty and move it into our today's leadership, whether it be faith, education, entertainment, politics, there is a deficit in self-awareness. Just watch the way people speak and you just don't hear people identifying parts of themselves based on their early imprint that could be affecting the way they're navigating their decisions. And if I ever see it in someone, I'm so drawn to it. For instance, if you ever see someone in significant leadership say, I don't know.
Oh, I know.
Or yes. I'm wrong.
Yes.
It's rare, but if you see it, it's just like it humanizes the experience. And I think it gives so many people permission to not create this unexpected or this unrealistic expectation of how to navigate life.
Absolutely. Every time I hear someone say that to me, I'm like, what a relief. So you don't know either. Like, cause I just feel like I'm trying to figure it out on most days, you know, which I think everyone is, but especially with social media, we all live in these personas of, I'm going to put this out. I mean, I do it too. I'm going to put this out there on my best day, looking my best, doing my best. And that's not realistic to real life.
Yeah.
Do you ever feel a pressure to be perfect or to have your shit together basically because of what you do for a living?
Yes.
What does that look like?
Well, I think for a while I really thought that that was about my profession. That was an easier thing to put it on, the mm-hmm. pressure and the difficulty, but it goes back. I mean, it's an early thing for me where, and I don't necessarily point it in any direction of thinking it was something someone did to me. It was just something I picked up along the way, whether it be in church, in family, in culture, I picked it up and it became important for me to get validated externally. And the only way to do that is, well, in my mind, the only way to do that is to be a high performer and to do things really well and to have it together. And when you get into my profession, you can kind of get validation from not having it together, especially mm-hmm. in today's climate. That's why you see so many people from stages that haven't done much of their own work, but they're now manufacturing vulnerability as a way to get validation from an audience.
Oh, wow. That's interesting.
And so I'm guilty of that too.
Yeah.
I started doing that early on and I tried to really watch it. It's like, am I vulnerable in this moment because it is helpful to my process and hopefully helpful to others, or am I doing it because I need their validation? And I think to some level, it's always a little bit of both. And I think it's okay as long as you know it.
Yeah.
But most people don't know it. And I think it was like 8 years ago when OnSite was starting to, people were starting to really notice what we were doing outside of therapeutic circles. And I began to start speaking to very small groups at the time that I was still single. And I had just come out of a very difficult, toxic relationship that I knew better. I shouldn't have gotten into, had all the information to tell me otherwise. And I was just at that time, I was desperate to find my partner. Mm-hmm. And I think I was desperate on two reasons. One, I was just dealing with some loneliness. And two, I thought this need to, you need to have family, be married in order to represent something that promotes healthy relationships. And so I unconsciously was chasing something for the wrong reason, and the outcome was predictable. I got into a pretty painful circumstance and it reactivated some of my old stuff. And I'll never forget having to sit in front of my team, and I trust my team emphatically. They're amazing. And just say, guys, I'm not my best right now. I'm not in a healthy spot and I'm going to need to step out and get healthy. And I'm going to, trust you guys to take this and do what I know you'll do well with. And they did. And it was amazing. And I stepped out and did some deep intensive work.
Wow.
But that was easier for me to do internally. It's taken years for me to talk about it externally. Mm-hmm. And I have talked about it a lot. It's taken years for me to say, oh yeah, there was a time, even at the peak of my career, where I had a wheels falling off moment and had to do something about it. So I do think it's what I learned from that, and now getting to work with a lot of people who are influencing at a big scale, regardless of where it is, it's a mega church pastor or an entertainer, there's too much pressure to not have grace and permission to have moments like that. And that's why I think so many people, we see them crash and falling apart, and we're seeing a spike in suicide and mental health issues. And it's frankly devastating because people are living with that message that I had at the time. It's just, I was thankful to be surrounded by good resources, or I could have been a statistic. But yeah, so I think what I've learned in that is that the profession itself can bring pressure, but ultimately it's more a core thing, if I really strip it back, that I have to continue to pursue and work on.
Right. It's a constant thing you'll always deal with. I feel like that to me, just the pressures like you're talking about. I heard you say too, you really love working with creatives and helping them in their experience. Is there something different you see with creatives and what they face versus what, a normal business person might face? Like, what are the different challenges?
Creatives, I think, are wired a little differently and therefore are can be highly sensitive. And that can be both a detriment and a significant advantage, because I think sensitive people who have creativity activated and on board, in a sense, become natural empaths.
Yeah.
And therefore take on what the world delivers and translates it for the rest of us through their art, whether it's a songwriter or an artist. And that can be, in a sense, you're a vessel. So you're taking this pain from your story or from other people's stories, translating it into something that is digestible for the rest of us to be able to unconsciously heal from. And that's a big ask if you think about it. And if you don't know that going in, then you can easily take on all that vicarious or secondary pain or trauma and couple that with your own, likely, which is maybe what got you into the business to begin with. And it can be a recipe for a significant challenge. But the advantage is when you get creatives into therapeutic or counseling or change circles, they typically thrive, which is one of the reasons there's two reasons I like working with creatives. Is I love the way they respond to the model I most aspire to, experiential.
Yeah.
And I feel I owe a debt to the creative, because the creative, there's a personal commitment there that I didn't have a lot of artistic influence growing up. I grew up in a tiny town in the South, and I love my town, such good people. But to be recognized, the easiest way was sports, outdoorsman. And I love those. And I excelled at both, and that's what I did. But I think there was always this creative, artistic part of me that was kind of screaming to have a voice. And I found my voice, my creative voice, and my emotion through music and film. And so some of the early times that I learned to cry was in a song or a movie. And I won't forget it. I still, it's the easiest thing. My favorite movies are sad movies.
Really?
Mm-hmm. And because I enjoy the cathartic release that I get when I go and cry. And so I'm a guy that likes chick flicks.
Love
and
that.
And it's, but I've always felt like, you know, how many people like me get to disappear for an hour and a half in a movie? Of course, movie theaters are a lost art, and now it's in your at home at Netflix.
Right.
But a song can take us somewhere else. And I believe art has the ability to change the world. And therefore, I've always felt like I owed a debt of service to the creative to keep them in the game.
Yeah. You said something about, I'm trying to find it in my notes because I think this is true. You said that you love the art of communication and connection, which when I heard that, I mean, this is kind of speaking to the creatives too. To me, I was like, yes, that is an art. And we don't ever talk about that, that is such an art to connect and to communicate with people. So let's talk a little bit about that, like connection. How important have you seen connection to be in this healing process?
I would simply say it's everything. I think that's what we're all looking for, hoping for, and longing to experience, is just to feel seen, heard, and valued, and kind of to give and receive empathy. And that's connection to me. Mm-hmm. And that's usually people who come to us, whether they're in struggle or they just want to raise their EQ and continue to dig and live a better life. They're a bit untethered or disconnected, because that's just what life does to us. And we get the opportunity. I think we get wounded in experience. And if people can curate experiences for us to heal in, then we can walk away feeling more grounded and connected. And we don't have to do that in therapeutic circles. That's another thing I advocate for, is I do think the world would benefit from counseling if it were available to everybody, or if everybody could afford it and do it. Yeah. But I also think that counseling and therapy from its principle or base shouldn't just be reserved for the anonymity of an office, and it should be humanized and be in our living rooms, and it should be the way we communicate. There's elements of it I think are important, and there's elements of it that I think, why have we done this in a closed door where nobody sees you, nobody hears you? And so I think anonymity has gotten too much emphasis, and therefore it keeps us from having meaningful, connected conversations. But that was, I went on a tangent there, but connection, I'm a big advocate for. And I do think there's a science to it, which clearly you can track. But I love creatives because there's an art in how they can clarify a complex circumstance and put it into a lyric, and it's the most beautiful thing ever.
I had a songwriter in a couple of weeks ago, Luke Dick, and he talked about that because I've always been envious of songwriters, honestly, because the way that they can put words out there that say exactly what I'm feeling, you know, they can verbalize it. And he said one of the biggest moments of connection for him is watching people in the audience, you know, nod to his lyrics or sing along, because he knows that in that moment they are the same and they feel the same thing, which was so beautiful to me. And it's such an interesting point of the creative art world that you're talking about.
Yeah. Yeah, the songs for me, and that's one of the reasons we work with so many songwriters and artists, is they just, I believe they change more hearts than we'll ever do at a place like OnSite.
Yeah. Let's talk about with connection. You know, there's two ways I think you can, that are important to connect, connecting with yourself and then connecting with others. How important is it to connect with yourself first before you're able to connect with others?
Great question. I think it's essential, but I don't think it's natural. So I think it can be a little bit of a setup to overprescribe that.
Okay. What do you mean?
Meaning that is insight that has been around for a while, but now it's really popular. Meaning, say, you can't love anybody until you love yourself.
Oh, yeah,
you can't
do
a relationship until you do a relationship with yourself. You can't connect. So I aspire to it. 100% believe it. But I try to give people grace on that, because I don't think we fully learn to connect with ourselves until we have a mirror of what connection looks like. And that's rare, because a lot of relationships don't experience true connection. They are set up with advice. And I believe connection is when I can go to you and share something challenging, difficult, or beautiful and inspiring, and you can catch that and hold it and just mirror it back and not try to change it or do anything with it. And whenever we experience that, it's just like, I really feel heard. I really feel seen. And that's, so basically, listening is a lost art. And I think when you feel truly listened to and mirrored from another human being, it teaches us to be able to do that with ourselves. So I believe connecting with ourselves is essential before we can do it with others. But sometimes others can teach us how to do it with ourselves.
You said on the All Our Favorite People podcast, they're two of my favorite people.
I love those guys.
But you said that you, when you hit kind of whatever you want to call it, your bottom or whatever, a huge thing that you realized about the depression and anxiety you were feeling was that it came from not being able to be the real you, or even to know the real you. Can you talk a little bit about that?
I mean, that's the beauty of any growth, personal growth pursuit is, that part is not linear. It doesn't, like, once you discover yourself, you land on it. Discovering yourself, I've learned in the personal growth process, is rediscovering yourself. And you do that as many times as you need to. It can be a daily walk, a weekly walk, or once a year, somebody might want to do a tune-up, and it's like, oh, there you are.
Yeah.
Here I am again. Because we go out into the world and we lose parts of ourselves. We never lose our core, I don't believe, but we lose parts of ourselves, and then we collect them. I love what Brené says about we don't connect the dots until we collect the dots. And I think that's a way of trying to integrate ourselves. And then I spoke at an event for creatives called Story a couple weeks ago, and Linda Wolverton, who is an incredible writer. She wrote Beauty and the Beast and Alice in Wonderland,
oh, wow,
Lion King,
yeah,
Homeward Bound. And that's just a few. She's just brilliant. She's a legend in that world. And I got a chance to talk to her. We had dinner and I was so inspired, because I'm obviously an aspiring author and working on a book, but can get hung up in my, in all the challenges of being a writer. But something she said that stood out to me was, she said, writing is rewriting. That's all it is. And when I heard that, I was like, oh my gosh, that's the same thing about discovering ourselves. It's rediscovering ourselves. Because I think people think you're supposed to land there. And I think it's one of those things that we're always going to lose parts of who we are, but we always get to get them back when we're in pursuit of that.
So it's kind of like what you said earlier about looking outside for your answers, but you actually know the answers inside. Like, you already know all the stuff, right? So you can, I'm trying to connect this rewriting thing. That's so, I've never heard that.
Well, it, yeah, ultimately, people would say that no one wants to have their problems pointed out to them. No one wants to be told you have a problem. And I think the reason people don't want to be told they have a problem is nobody also shares that you also have the solution. And I think when you hear it that way, it's a much more invitational opportunity. It's like we all have problems, but we all have the solutions. And that's, in a sense, a really good guide, which I think really good therapists, counselors, friends are just guides in their own right, meaning they don't have to be the hero of the story. They can just be Yoda and, you know, walk you through the dark. But to do that effectively, you have to really sideline your ego and what you think you know and hold space for somebody to find ultimately what they need to do. And it really good therapy is incredible listening and holding space. And it is a true art. But if you can, and it's frustrating for someone you're talking to, because when we are in pain or stuck in struggle, we want someone to tell us what we do. We crave it. It's like, give me the three steps to get the heck out of here.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's what most self-help books will tell you. And to be honest, I'm not, when I write mine, it'll probably be in the self-help category and it will probably have some steps because that's just what people consume. But I hope I can do it in a way where I'm not over-promising that that's going to fix you or create sustainable change, because it's just deeper than that. It's more layered. And when people find their own answer, they are, again, I said this in the beginning, twice as likely to integrate it. Mm-hmm. It's just we have to have the patience to support people and give them the confidence to get there.
That is so true, because I'm a recovering advice giver. And
I like that.
Yeah. You know, it's so, sometimes it's so easy in other people to see what you're like, oh, if you would just do this, this would get better. But until they're actually ready, it's not going to settle in. Or I've heard also too, denial, ripping someone out of denial is almost cruel, because sometimes that's their protector and they need that denial to survive in that moment. But I don't know. And I know it's true for me. If someone tells me what to do, I'm like, whatever. And then a month later, I'm like, oh man, that was right. You know, until you're ready, you're just not ready.
Well, there's as with everything, this is something that I'm glad to hear you subscribe to it too. There's exceptions. I mean, if somebody's, you know, really in a dire circumstance,
sure,
on the edge, standing on the bridge, then you do what you need to do. All bets are off and you intervene with whatever tools that you have available and confront, grab, pull off, do whatever you need to do. But when you're with someone who's genuinely safe, but they're curious and stuck and trying, that's where the magic is.
Yeah.
Creating curious. A highway for them to find their own answer.
You talked a little bit about the relationship you were in after you started on site. So had you done a lot of work of maybe these intensives and that kind of thing before you got married?
I had. You mean couples intensives or individual?
Or just individual. Like,
yeah. I did a lot. I've done a lot of work over the years.
Yeah.
And prior to getting involved at OnSite, I ran another program that was a residential treatment program for addictions, eating disorders, and trauma. It's more longer term. And so I learned a lot in that space. But I have always kind of done my own work ever since that initial imprint. There's been seasons where I haven't done as much of it, but I've tried to stay consistent with it. I've always looked at it like it's not something I have to do. It's something I get to do. And I'm opting in and choosing because I've just experienced the value in it. Whether life's going beautifully or whether life is struggling, that's why I describe it, or I like to describe it, as emotional fitness, because I just think it's something we treat just like our physical health and continue to do it.
So when you met your wife, had she done work too? I guess, let me tell you what I'm trying to get at here.
Okay.
I'm curious, and this is probably because of my own dating experiences. Is it possible, as someone who's connected in that way and done a little bit of work even, or kind of had that eye-opening experience, those aha moments Oprah talks about, can you be with someone who has not done that themselves? Or did you find yourself being drawn to people who were like-minded and could speak the language?
Yes, you can do that without someone. And I think we have to be careful, this is just, again, in my opinion, take it for what it's worth, of not and I say this from experience because I did it, where I unconsciously created a platform for myself and other people who had done work and were a little bit more evolved than others who haven't. And there is a language that can familiarize your life experience after you've done some personal work that is so comforting and so insightful and so, in some cases, necessary. But I believe that when you continue to work on yourself, you don't search for safety out there. You realize safety exists in here. And therefore, you can be in relationships and with people and around people who don't speak the same language, who don't necessarily have the same skill sets, and be able to take care of yourself in that environment and see the good in them. And be also see where you need to put boundaries up around unreconciled things. But without work, we typically can get trauma bonded or drawn to, and even with work, because when you do the work, you're not perfect. You
know, exactly.
I still, you know, can be attracted to or drawn friendships. I had a really good friend of mine who got after me 2-3 years ago in a kind way. She has permission to do that because we pour into each other a lot. But she said, "Miles, you've got to stop hiring to heal." And I was like, "Ooh!" I mean, it hit me right at my core because I didn't recognize I was doing that. I'd cleaned up a lot of my codependent behaviors in my social circles, and I was getting a need met or a fix with people I was hiring in my organization. So I would, amazing, talented people, incredibly unreconciled in parts of their lives. And I unconsciously would be like, I think our culture could benefit you. And I think you could benefit our culture. And I ended up, you know, you can, it's predictable. It was 2 years of a mess. It was the wrong intention. And so I had to learn not to hire to heal. And I, that's 10 years into having all this information.
Oh, totally. I mean, and also it's one of those things, like you said, you can do a lot of work, especially in one area of your life. And before you know it, or this is what's happened to me, at least, I've done a lot of work around dating and those kind of things, because that's where a lot of my trauma has been. But then, like you said, it started to seep, or not seep, it was always there, but I started to recognize it in the other areas of my life. And it just, I couldn't even see it because this stuff was so big first, you know?
And yeah, for instance, my wife, she doesn't like therapy talk.
Oh, really?
Oh my gosh. She can't. She rolls her eyes at me.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's interesting.
We have wonderfully deep conversations, but it can't always start with through the lens of my language.
Right.
And I had a lot of false starts and failed attempts of trying to change her and her other relationships to start talking more and learning more like me. And now I think I've learned to appreciate that it is important, I think, if you really value growth and evolving and trying to be a better person and always looking at your marriage as not stable, but trying to grow it. I say marriage, relationship, whatever, your partnership, whatever it is for someone, that you hopefully have a willing partner that's not stagnant. That's where I've seen people really get hung up. If you've got one that's in a fixed position and the other that is willing to grow, but growth looks different for everybody.
And that's a hard one, because I want it to look exactly the same, because then I'm like, okay, now I'm safe because you're doing it too. And I recognize it.
But my favorite mentors and teachers who've been in pursuit of becoming a better version or reconciling old pain, whether it be through a spiritual lens or a psychology lens, are the ones who can live it without the words. And so I want somebody who, if somebody's trying to talk to me about their faith, I don't want that script or that language. I want to feel it. I want to feel grace, love, connection. And I don't want somebody to preach to me.
Right.
We're talking a lot about it, and I appreciate it because I can, you have an interest, and I would imagine hopefully a lot of your listeners might have an interest too. I don't often get to talk this much in a therapeutic language, but I'm trying to evolve into a spot where I have it, but I don't need it to represent who I am, because I want to represent the gifts of it versus the how to get there.
That is so interesting. I think that's also a huge part of the connecting with yourself and kind of knowing maybe how you can hear it, but finding the core of that and being able to communicate that versus the language and all of that. You said you don't get to communicate this way that often about it, but you do have the podcast platform that you guys, that's how you speak, right? On the Unspoken Podcast.
We do, yeah, for the most part. When we started that, the idea was, how do you take the concept of, or the principles of self-work or counseling and therapy and make them digestible for everybody else. Mm-hmm. And so that was where, and I had people ask me all the time, what do you do at OnSite? And then I would get lost in, well, we have the, all the, and then.
Well, it's a huge answer, first of all.
It is. And then I finally was like, well, to be honest, we just help people say the unsaid.
I love that. Say the unsaid.
And that's where the podcast was born out of. It was sometimes that's going backwards into your past. Sometimes it's current. Sometimes it's speaking truth into where you're, where you want to go or who you're becoming, but it's say the unsaid, and then unspoken was born from that. And so I bring in things I've been trained and learned from way smarter people than me that work at OnSite. But I, ultimately we try to humanize the vulnerable, deep conversation. That's what unspoken has been about.
Some of your guests that, I mean, you guys have huge guests, Bob Goff, Ariel Vandenberg, John Batiste, Richard Rohr. I was like, they were on the Oprah podcast. How did you guys get connected in that way?
You know, Ruthie was a big part of that.
This is your co-host, Ruthie Lindsay.
My co-host. Yeah. And she was able to connect some of those dots, some of those relationships I had through OnSite. And it was just kind of, it's shocked us too, that people said, yes, I'd be happy to be a part of that. And, for the longest time with, OnSite, it's challenging because we do connect with, and I have a relationship with a lot of interesting people doing amazing things, mm-hmm. but it's complicated because we try to keep a lot of that anonymous and confidential. And therefore I've never asked much of anybody for anything. And now I'm starting to realize that, you know, I very rarely have a therapeutic relationship with someone who would get services at OnSite. I'm just kind of the bridge to support them to get there. And then we've got a great therapeutic clinical team. Mm-hmm. And so I've started to be a little bit more proactive in, obviously following the integrity and the guidelines of our profession, but just having friendships, because friendships travel. And I've learned that podcasts and things like what you're doing can reach more people than we can at OnSite. And I think that's what's important for culture right now. So I have started asking more people. But between Ruthie and I, we were just so fortunate that people said yes, particularly people like Richard Rohr, who I've looked up to his work for years. And well, everybody, I've loved all of our guests, but we've had some amazing people.
So you mentioned before we started that you're also going to be starting a podcast with OnSite.
Yes, that was kind of born. I didn't know in the beginning if how I would do with podcasting. It was such, we were talking about that earlier.
No, totally. I was the same.
And it's a skill. It's a whole, and some of it comes natural and then some of it is really learned. Mm-hmm. But I found I really love it. And one of the things that we were attempting to do in Unspoken was we were particular about the guests that we wanted, and we were particular about how we wanted the conversations to flow. And I often felt a little limited to share more about my world, emotional health, mm-hmm. mental health, therapy. And we share a lot about it. Don't get me wrong. That's a lot of the undertone of Unspoken. But a lot of people ask for more. Can you say more about emotional trauma? Can you say more about this depression? And I just often didn't feel like that was the format to do it. And so this will be the format that I'll get to really have free reign to go for it. There's so many amazing people that work at OnSite, that are affiliated with OnSite, and then that come through OnSite.
Right.
And they all have awesome stories. And so we're going to start by interviewing some of my friends in the clinical world, some of our team at OnSite, and then some amazing alumni that have been through OnSite, and just see where we go from there.
Well, I personally can't wait for that. That'll be my therapy sometimes. So where can people find you? You have the Unspoken podcast that's out now. You guys have done 2 seasons, right?
Right. Yeah.
And then when will this OnSite podcast be out?
We're going to be launching it early in 2020. So just in a few months.
Exciting.
And our marquee program is called the Living Centered Program. Mm-hmm. And so this podcast will be called the Living Centered Podcast.
Amazing.
And I'll be putting it up on our social channels when we're closer to figuring out the release date. So you can kind of keep an eye on either at OnSite workshops or at Miles Adcox, and between the two of us, we'll try to communicate that when it gets closer.
And it's Miles, M-I-L-E-S, correct?
Yes.
Adcox. So at Miles Adcox at OnSite. The OnSite website is amazing too. It's super informative if people are interested. What is it? Is it just OnSite.com?
OnSiteWorkshops.com.
OnSiteWorkshops.com. Thank you so much for being here. I've wanted to talk to you for a really long time, so this is really exciting and fulfilling for me because I love this kind of conversation.
Thank you so much. This was one of my more fun podcasts. This was fun. Thank you.
Awesome. Thank you guys for listening. This is Kelly Henderson, and you've been listening to the Velvet's Edge podcast. I truly believe that every one of us has a little velvet and a little edge. So it's so important to remember that to be strong, you must be soft too. Thank you so much for sharing in those stories with me. You can follow Velvet's Edge on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter, as well as velvetsedge.com. If you haven't yet, go to Apple Podcasts and subscribe, rate, and review this podcast. Join me every Wednesday for more conversations on lifestyle, beauty, and relationships. Thanks for listening.